paddled through the water to the shore, and Ruthie looked with interest and amazement at his naked body. Tom, seeing the direction of her eyes, said, "Run on now, get!" And Ruthie ran. Tom heard her calling excitedly for Winfield as she went. He put the hot clothes on his cool, wet body, and he walked slowly up through the willows toward the tent. Ma had started a fire of dry willow twigs, and she held a pan of water heating. She looked relieved when she saw him. "What's the matter, Ma?" he asked.
"I was scared," she said. "They was a policeman here. He says we can't stay here. I was scared he'd talk to you. I was scared you'd hit him if he talked to you."
Tom said,
"What did I go and hit a policeman for?"
Ma smiled.
"Well, he talked so bad, I nearly hit him myself."
Tom grabbed her arm and shook her roughly and loosely, and he laughed. He sat down on the ground, still laughing.
"My God, Ma, I knowed you when you was gentle. What's come over you?"
She looked serious.
"I don't know, Tom. First you stand us off with a jackhandle, and now you try to hit a cop."
He laughed softly, and he reached out and patted her bare foot tenderly.
"Oh, hellcat," he said.
"Tom?"
"Yeah?"
She hesitated a long time.
"Tom, this here policeman, he called us Okies. He says, we don't want you goddamn Okies settling down."
Tom studied her, and his hand still rested gently on her bare foot.
"Fella told about that," he said. "Fella told how they say it."
He considered.
"Ma, would you say I was a bad fella? Ought to be locked up like that?"
"No,"
she said.
"You been tried?"
"No." "What you asked me for?"
"Well, I don't know. I'd have took a sock at that cop."
Ma smiled with amusement.
"Maybe I ought to asked you that, 'cause I nearly hit him with a skillet."
"Ma, why'd he say we couldn't stop here?"
"Just says they don't want no damn Okies settling down. Says he's gonna run us in if we're here tomorrow."
"But we ain't used to getting shoved around by no cops."
"I told him that," said Ma. "He says we ain't home now. We're in California, and they do what they want."
Tom said uneasily,
"Ma, I got something to tell you. Noah, he went on down the river. He ain't a-going on."
It took a moment for Ma to understand.
"Why?"
she asked softly.
"I don't know. Says he got to. Says he got to stay. Says for me to tell you."
"How will he eat?"
she demanded.
"I don't know. Says he'll catch fish."
Ma was silent a long time.
"Family's falling apart,"
she said.
"I don't know. Seems like I can't think no more. I just can't think. There's too much."
Tom said lamely,
"He'll be all right, Ma. He's a funny kind of fella."
Ma turned stunned eyes toward the river.
"I just can't seem to think no more."
Tom looked down the line of tents, and he saw Ruthie and Winfield standing in front of a tent in decorous conversation with someone inside. Ruthie was twisting her skirt in her hands, while Winfield dug a hole in the ground with his toe. Tom called,
"You, Ruthie."
She looked up and saw him, and trotted toward him, with Winfield behind her. When she came up, Tom said,
"You go get our folks. They're sleeping down the willows. Get them, and you, Winfield. You tell the Wilsons we're gonna get rolling soon as we can."
The children spun around and charged off.
Tom said, "Ma, how's Grandma now?"
"Well, she got to sleep today. Maybe she's better. She's still asleepin'.
That's good.
How much pork we got?
Not very much.
Quarter hog.
Well, we got to fill that other keg with water. Got to take water along.
They could hear Ruthie's shrill cries for the men down in the willows. Ma shoved willow sticks into the fire and made it crackle up about the black pot. She said,
I pray God we're gonna get some rest. I pray Jesus we're gonna lay down in a nice place.
The sun sank toward the baked and broken hills to the west. The pot over the fire bubbled furiously. Ma went under the tarpaulin and came out with an apron full of potatoes, and she dropped them into the boiling water.
I pray God we're gonna be let to wash some clothes. We ain't never been dirty like this. Don't even wash potatoes for we boil 'em. I wonder why. Seems like the hearts took out of us.
The men came trooping up from the willows, and their eyes were full of sleep, and their faces were red and puffed with daytime sleep. Pa said,
What's the matter?
We're going, said Tom. Cop says we gotta go. Might's well get her over, get a good start, and maybe we'll be through her. Near 300 miles where we're going.
Pa said,
I thought we was gonna get a rest.
Well, we ain't. We gotta go.
Pa, Tom said, Noah ain't a-goin'. He walked on down the river.
Ain't going? What the hell's the matter with him?
And then Pa caught himself.
My fault, he said miserably. That boy's all my fault.
No.
I don't want to talk about it no more,
said Pa.
I can't. My fault.
Well, we got to go, said Tom.
Wilson walked near for the last words.
We can't go, folks, he said. Sari's done up. She got to rest. She ain't gonna get across that desert alive.
They were silent at his words. Then Tom said,
Cop says he'll run us in if we're here tomorrow.
Wilson shook his head. His eyes were glazed with worry, and a paleness showed through his dark skin.
Just have to do her, then. Sari can't go. If they jail us, why, they'll have to jail us. She got to rest and get strong.
Pa said,
Maybe we better wait and all go together.
No, Wilson said. You been nice to us. You been kin. But you can't stay here. You gotta get on and get jobs and work. We ain't gonna let you stay.
Pa said excitedly,
But you ain't got nothing.
Wilson smiled.
Never had nothing when you took us up. That ain't none of your business. Don't you make me get mean. You got to go, or I'll get mean and mad.
Ma beckoned Pa into the cover of the tarpaulin and spoke softly to him. Wilson turned to Casey.
Sari wants you should go see her.
Sure,
said the preacher. He walked to the Wilson tent, tiny and gray, and he slipped the flaps aside and entered. It was dusky and hot inside. The mattress lay on the ground, and the equipment was scattered about, as it had been unloaded in the morning. Sari lay on the mattress, her eyes wide and bright. He stood and looked down at her, his large head bent and the stringy muscles of his neck tight along the sides, and he took off his hat and held it in his hand. She said,
Did my man tell you we couldn't go on?
That's what he said.
Her low, beautiful voice went on.
I wanted us to go. I knowed I wouldn't live to the other side, but he'd be across anyways. But he won't go. He don't know. He thinks it's gonna be all right. He don't know.
He says he won't go.
I know, she said. And he's stubborn. I asked you to come to say a prayer.
I ain't a preacher,
he said softly.
My prayers ain't no good.
She moistened her lips.
I was there when the old man died.
You said one then. It wasn't no prayer.
It was a prayer.
It wasn't no preacher's prayer.
It was a good prayer. I want you should say one for me.
I don't know what to say.
She closed her eyes for a minute, and then opened them again.
Then say one to yourself. Don't use no words to it. That'd be all right.
I got no God,
he said.
You got a God. Don't make no difference if you don't know what he looks like.
The preacher bowed his head. She watched him apprehensively. And when he raised his head again, she looked relieved.
That's good, she said. That's what I needed. Somebody close enough to pray.
He shook his head as though to awaken himself.
I don't understand this here,
he said, and she replied,
Yes, you know, don't you?
I know,
he said.
I know, but I don't understand. Maybe you'll rest a few days and then come on.
She shook her head slowly from side to side.
I'm just pain covered with skin. I know what it is, but I won't tell him. He'd be too sad. He wouldn't know what to do anyways. Maybe in the night, when he's asleepin'. When he waked up, it won't be so bad.
You want I should stay with you and not go on?
No, she said. No. When I was a little girl, I used to sing. Folks around about used to say I sung as nice as Jenny Lind. Folks used to come and listen when I sung. And when they stood and me a-singin', why, me and them was together more'n you could ever know. I was thankful. There ain't so many folks can feel so full up, so close, and them folks standin' there and me a-singin'. Thought maybe I'd sing in theaters, but I never done it. And I'm glad. There wasn't nothing got in between me and them. And that's why I wanted you to pray. I wanted to feel that closeness once more. It's the same thing, singing and praying. Just the same thing. I wished you could have heard me sing.
He looked down at her, into her eyes.
Goodbye, he said.
She shook her head slowly back and forth and closed her lips tight, and the preacher went out of the dusky tent into the blinding light. The men were loading up the truck, Uncle John on top, while the others passed equipment up to him. He stowed it carefully, keeping the surface level. Ma emptied the quarter of a keg of salt pork into a pan, and Tom and Al took both little barrels to the river and washed them. They tied them to the running boards and carried water in buckets to fill them. Then over the tops, they tied canvas to keep them from slopping the water out. Only the tarpaulin and Grandma's mattresses were left to be put on. Tom said,
With the load we'll take, this old wagon'll boil her head off. We got to have plenty water.
Ma passed the boiled potatoes out and brought the half sack from the tent and put it with the pan of pork. The family ate standing, shuffling their feet and tossing the hot potatoes from hand to hand until they cooled. Ma went to the Wilson tent and stayed for 10 minutes, and then she came out quietly.
It's time to go, she said.
The men went under the tarpaulin. Grandma still slept, her mouth wide open, They lifted the whole mattress gently and passed it up on top of the truck. Grandma drew up her skinny legs and frowned in her sleep, but she did not awaken. Uncle John and Pa tied the tarpaulin over the crosspiece, making a little tight tent on top of the load. They lashed it down to the side bars, and then they were ready. Pa took out his purse and dug two crushed bills from it. He went to Wilson and held them out.
"We want you should take this," and
he pointed to the pork and potatoes.
"In that."
Wilson hung his head and shook it sharply.
"I ain't a-gonna do it," he said. "You ain't got much."
"Got enough to get there," said Pa. "We ain't left at all. We'll have work right off."
"I ain't a-gonna do it," Wilson said. "I'll get mean if you try."
Ma took the two bills from Pa's hand. She folded them neatly and put them on the ground and placed the pork pan over them. "That's where they'll be," she said. "If you don't get 'em, somebody else will." Wilson, his head still down, turned and went to his tent. He stepped inside, and the flaps fell behind him. For a few moments, the family waited, and then,
"We got to go," said Tom. "It's near 4, I bet."
The family climbed on the truck, Ma on top, beside Grandma, Tom and Al and Pa in the seat, and Winfield on Pa's lap. Connie and Rose of Sharon made a nest against the cab. The preacher and Uncle John and Ruthie were in a tangle on the load. Pa called,
"Goodbye, Mr. and Mrs. Wilson."
There was no answer from the tent. Tom started the engine, and the truck lumbered away. And as they crawled up the rough road toward Needles and the highway, Ma looked back. Wilson stood in front of his tent, staring after them, and his hat was in his hand. The sun fell full on his face. Ma waved her hand at him, but he did not respond. Tom kept the truck in second gear over the rough road to protect the springs. At Needles, he drove into a service station, checked the worn tires for air, checked the spares tied to the back. He had the gas tank filled, and he bought 2 5-gallon cans of gasoline and a 2-gallon can of oil. He filled the radiator, begged a map, and studied it. The service station boy in his white uniform seemed uneasy until the bill was paid. He said,
"You people sure have got nerve."
Tom looked up from the map.
"What you mean?"
"Well, crossing in a jalopy like this."
"You been acrossed?"
"Sure, plenty, but not in no wreck like this."
Tom said,
"If we broke down, maybe somebody'd give us a hand."
"Well, maybe. But folks are kind of scared to stop at night. I'd hate to be doing it. Takes more nerve than I've got."
Tom grinned.
"It don't take no nerve to do something when there ain't nothing else you can do. Well, thanks. We'll drag on."
And he got in the truck and moved away. The boy in white went into the iron building where his helper labored over a book of bills.
"Jesus, what a hard-looking outfit.
Them Okies, they're all hard-looking.
Jesus, I'd hate to start out in a jalopy like that."
"Well, you and me got sense. Them goddamn Okies got no sense and no feeling. They ain't human. A human being wouldn't live like they do. A human being couldn't stand it to be so dirty and miserable. They ain't a hell of a lot better than gorillas."
"Just the same, I'm glad I ain't crossing the desert in no Hudson Super 6. She sounds like a threshing machine."
The other boy looked down at his book of bills, and a big drop of sweat rolled down his finger and fell on the pink bills.
"You know, they don't have much trouble. They're so goddamn dumb, they don't know it's dangerous. And Christ almighty, they don't know any better than what they got. Why worry?"
"I'm not worrying. Just thought if it was me, I wouldn't like it."
"That's 'cause you know better. They don't know any better."
And he wiped the sweat from the pink bill with his sleeve. The truck took the road and moved up the long hill, through the broken, rotten rock. The engine boiled very soon, and Tom slowed down and took it easy. Up the long slope, winding and twisting through dead country, burned white and gray, and no hint of life in it. Once Tom stopped for a few moments to let the engine cool, and then he traveled on. They topped the pass while the sun was still up, and looked down on the desert, black cinder mountains in the distance, and the yellow sun reflected on the gray desert. The little starved bushes, sage and greasewood, threw bold shadows on the sand and bits of rock. The glaring sun was straight ahead. Tom held his hand before his eyes to see it all. They passed the crest and coasted down to cool the engine. They coasted down the long sweep to the floor of the desert, and the fan turned over to cool the water in the radiator. In the driver's seat, Tom and Al and Pa and Winfield on Pa's knee looked into the bright descending sun, and their eyes were stony, and their brown faces were damp with perspiration. The burnt land and the black cindery hills broke the even distance and made it terrible in the reddening light of the setting sun. Al said,
"Jesus, what a place. How'd you like to walk across her?"
"People done it," said Tom. "Lots of people done it. And if they could, we could."
"Lots must have died," said Al.
"Well, we ain't come out exactly clean." Al was silent for a while, and the reddening desert swept past.
"Think we'll ever see them Wilsons again?"
Al asked. Tom flicked his eyes down to the oil gauge. "I got a hunch nobody ain't gonna see Ms. Wilson for long. Just a hunch I got."
Winfield said, "Pa, I want to get out."
Tom looked over at him.
"Might's well let everybody out before we settle down to driving tonight."
He slowed the car and brought it to a stop. Winfield scrambled out and urinated at the side of the road. Tom leaned out.
"Anybody else?"
"We're holding our water up here," Uncle John called.
Pa said, "Winfield, you crawl up on top. You put my legs to sleep a-settin' on 'em."
The little boy buttoned his overalls and obediently crawled up the backboard, and on his hands and knees crawled over Grandma's mattress and forward to Ruthie. The truck moved on into the evening, and the edge of the sun struck the rough horizon and turned the desert red. Ruthie said,
"Wouldn't leave you set up there, huh?"
"I didn't want to. It wasn't so nice as here. Couldn't lie down."
"Well, don't you bother me a squawking and a talking," Ruthie said, "'cause I'm going to sleep, and when I wake up, we gonna be there, 'cause Tom said so. Gonna seem funny to see pretty country."
The sun went down and left a great halo in the sky, and it grew very dark under the tarpaulin, a long cave with light at each end, a flat triangle of light. Connie and Rose of Sharon leaned back against the cab, and the hot wind tumbling through the tent struck the backs of their heads, and the tarpaulin whipped and drummed above them. They spoke together in low tones, pitched to the drumming canvas, so that no one could hear them. When Connie spoke, he turned his head and spoke into her ear, and she did the same to him. She said,
"Seems like we wasn't never gonna do nothing but move. I'm so tired."
He turned his head to her ear.
"Maybe in the morning. How'd you like to be alone now?"
In the dusk, his hand moved out and stroked her hip. She said,
"Don't. You'll make me crazy as a loon. Don't do that."
And she turned her head to hear his response.
"Maybe when everybody's asleep."
"Maybe," she said. "But wait till they get to sleep. You'll make me crazy. And maybe they won't get to sleep."
"I can't hardly stop," he said.
"I know. Me neither. Let's talk about when we get there, and you move away before I get crazy."
He shifted away a little.
"Well,
I'll get to studying nights right off, he said. She sighed deeply.
Gonna get one of them books that tells about it and cut the coupon right off.
How long, you think? She asked.
How long what?
How long for you'll be making big money and we got ice?
Can't tell, he said importantly. Can't really rightly tell. Fella ought to be studied up pretty good for Christmas.
Soon as you get studied up, we could get ice and stuff, I guess.
He chuckled. It's this here heat, he said. What you gonna need ice around Christmas for?
She giggled. That's right. But I'd like ice any time. Now don't. You get me crazy.
The dusk passed into dark, and the desert stars came out in the soft sky, stars stabbing and sharp, with few points and rays to them, and the sky was velvet. And the heat changed. While the sun was up, it was a beating, flailing heat, but now the heat came from below, from the earth itself, and the heat was thick and muffling. The lights of the truck came on, and they illuminated a little blur of highway ahead, and a strip of desert on either side of the road. And sometimes eyes gleamed in the lights far ahead, but no animal showed in the lights. It was pitch dark under the canvas now. Uncle John and the preacher were curled in the middle of the truck, resting on their elbows, and staring out the back triangle. They could see the two bumps that were Ma and Grandma against the outside. They could see Ma move occasionally, and her dark arm moving against the outside. Uncle John talked to the preacher.
Casey, he said, you're a fella ought to know what to do. What to do about what? I don't know, said Uncle John.
Casey said,
well, that's gonna make it easy for me. Well, you've been a preacher. Look, John, everybody takes a crack at me 'cause I've been a preacher. A preacher ain't nothing but a man. Yeah, but he's a kind of a man, else he wouldn't be a preacher. I want to ask you, well, you think a fella could bring bad luck to folks? I dunno, said Casey. I dunno. Well, see, I was married, fine, good girl, and one night she got a pain in her stomach, and she says, you better get a doctor. And I says, hell, you just ate too much.
Uncle John put his hand on Casey's knee, and he peered through the darkness at him.
She gave me a look, and she groaned all night, and she died the next afternoon.
The preacher mumbled something.
You see, John went on, I killed her. And since then, I tried to make it up, mostly to kids. And I tried to be good, and I can't. I get drunk, and I go wild. Everybody goes wild, said Casey. I do, too. Yeah, but you ain't got a sin on your soul like me.
Casey said gently,
sure, I got sins. Everybody got sins. A sin is something you ain't sure about. Them people that's sure about everything and ain't got no sin, well, with that kind of son of a bitch, if I was God, I'd kick their ass right out of heaven. I couldn't stand 'em.
Uncle John said,
I got a feeling I'm bringing bad luck to my own folks. I got a feeling I ought to go away and let 'em be. I ain't comfortable being like this.
Casey said quickly,
I know this. A man got to do what he got to do. I can't tell you. I can't tell you. I don't think there's luck or bad luck. Only one thing in this world I'm sure of, and that's I'm sure nobody got a right to mess with a fella's life. He got to do it all himself. Help him, maybe, but not tell him what to do.
Uncle John said disappointedly,
then you don't know? I don't know. You think it was a sin to let my wife die like that?
Well, said Casey, for anybody else it was a mistake. But if you think it was a sin, then it's a sin. A fella builds his own sins right up from the ground.
I gotta give that a going over,
said Uncle John, and he rolled on his back and lay with his knees pulled up. The truck moved on over the hot earth, and the hours passed. Ruthie and Winfield went to sleep. Connie loosened a blanket from the load and covered himself and Rose of Sharon with it, and in the heat they struggled together and held their breaths. And after a time, Connie threw off the blanket, and the hot tunneling wind felt cool on their wet bodies. On the back of the truck, Ma lay on the mattress beside Grandma, and she could not see with her eyes, but she could feel the struggling body and the struggling heart, and the sobbing breath was in her ear. And Ma said over and over, "All right. It's gonna be all right." And she said hoarsely, "You know the family got to get across.
You know that."
Uncle John called, "You all right?" It was a moment before she answered.
"All right. Guess I dropped off to sleep."
And after a time, Grandma was still, and Ma lay rigid beside her. The night hours passed, and the dark was in against the truck. Sometimes cars passed them, going west and away, and sometimes great trucks came up out of the west and rumbled eastward. And the stars flowed down in a slow cascade over the western horizon. It was near midnight when they neared Daggett, where the inspection station is. The road was floodlighted there, and a sign illuminated, "Keep right and stop." The officers loafed in the office, but they came out and stood under the long covered shed when Tom pulled in. One officer put down the license number and raised the hood. Tom asked, "What's this here?"
"Agricultural inspection. We got to look over your stuff. Got any vegetables or seeds?"
"No," said Tom.
"Well, we got to look over your stuff. You got to unload."
Now Ma climbed heavily down from the truck. Her face was swollen, and her eyes were hard.
"Look, mister, we got a sick old lady. We got to get her to a doctor. We can't wait." She seemed to fight with hysteria. "You can't make us wait."
"Yeah, well, we got to look you over."
"I swear we ain't got anything," Ma cried. "I swear it. And Grandma's awful sick."
"You don't look so good yourself," the officer said.
Ma pulled herself up the back of the truck, hoisted herself with huge strength.
"Look,"
she said. The officer shot a flashlight beam up on the old shrunken face.
"By God, she is," he said. "You swear you got no seeds or fruits or vegetables, no corn, no oranges?"
"No, no, I swear it."
"Then go ahead. You can get a doctor in Barstow. That's only 8 miles. Go on ahead."
Tom climbed in and drove on. The officer turned to his companion.
"I couldn't hold him."
"Maybe it was a bluff," said the other.
"Oh, Jesus, no. You should have seen that old woman's face. That wasn't no bluff."
Tom increased his speed to Barstow, and in the little town he stopped, got out, and walked around the truck. Ma leaned out.
"It's all right," she said. "I didn't want to stop there. Fear we wouldn't get across."
"Yeah, but how's Grandma?"
"She's all right." "All right, drive on. We got to get across."
Tom shook his head and walked back. "Al," he said, "I'm gonna fill her up and then you drive some." He pulled to an all-night gas station and filled the tank and the radiator and filled the crankcase. Then Al slipped under the wheel and Tom took the outside with Pa in the middle. They drove away into the darkness, and the little hills near Barstow were behind them. Tom said,
I don't know what's got into Ma. She's flighty as a dog with a flea in his ear. Wouldn't have took long to look over the stuff. And she says Grandma's sick, and now she says Grandma's all right. I can't figure her out. She ain't right. Suppose she wore her brains out on the trip.
Pa said,
Ma's almost like she was when she was a girl. She was a wild one then. She wasn't scared of nothing. I thought having all the kids and working took it out of her, but I guess it ain't. Christ, when she got that jack handle back there, I tell you I wouldn't want to be the fella took it away from her.
I dunno what's got into her, Tom said. Maybe she's just tired out.
Al said, I won't be doing no weeping and a moaning to get through. I got this goddamn car on my soul.
Tom said, well, you done a damn good job of picking. We ain't had hardly no trouble with her at all.
All night they bored through the hot darkness, and jackrabbits scuttled into the lights and dashed away in long, jolting leaps. And the dawn came up behind them when the lights of Mojave were ahead. And the dawn showed high mountains to the west. They filled their water and oil at Mojave and crawled into the mountains, and the dawn was about them. Tom said,
Jesus, the desert's passed. Pa, Al, for Christ's sakes, the desert's passed.
I'm too goddamn tired to care, said Al.
Want me to drive?
No, wait a while. They drove through Tehachapi in the morning glow, and the sun came up behind them, and then, suddenly, they saw the great valley below them. Al jammed on the brake and stopped in the middle of the road, and,
Jesus Christ, look, he said.
The vineyards, the orchards, the great flat valley, green and beautiful, the trees set in rows, and the farmhouses. And Pa said,
God Almighty.
The distant cities, the little towns and the orchard land, and the morning sun golden on the valley. A car honked behind them. Al pulled to the side of the road and parked.
I want to look at her.
The grain fields golden in the morning, and the willow lines, the eucalyptus trees in rows. Pa sighed,
I never knowed there was anything like her.
The peach trees and the walnut groves, and the dark green patches of oranges, and red roofs among the trees, and barns, rich barns. Al got out and stretched his legs. He called,
Ma, come look, we're there.
Ruthie and Winfield scrambled down from the car, and then they stood, silent and awestruck, embarrassed before the great valley. The distance was thinned with haze, and the land grew softer and softer in the distance. A windmill flashed in the sun, and its turning blades were like a little heliograph far away. Ruthie and Winfield looked at it, and Ruthie whispered,
It's California.
Winfield moved his lips silently over the syllables.
There's fruit, he said aloud.
Casey and Uncle John, Connie and Rose of Sharon climbed down, and they stood silently. Rose of Sharon had started to brush her hair back when she caught sight of the valley, and her hand dropped slowly to her side. Tom said,
Where's Ma? I want Ma to see it. Look, Ma! Come here, Ma!
Ma was climbing slowly, stiffly down the backboard. Tom looked at her.
My God, Ma, you sick?
Her face was stiff and putty-like, and her eyes seemed to have sunk deep into her head, and the rims were red with weariness. Her feet touched the ground, and she braced herself by holding the truck side. Her voice was a croak.
You say, we're across?
Tom pointed to the great valley.
Look!
She turned her head, and her mouth opened a little.
Her fingers went to her throat and gathered a little pinch of skin and twisted gently.
"Thank God," she said. "The family's here."
Her knees buckled, and she sat down on the running board.
"You sick, Ma?"
"No,
just tired."
"Didn't you get no sleep?"
"No."
"Was Grandma bad?" Ma looked down at her hands, lying together like tired lovers in her lap.
"I wished I could wait and not tell you. I wished it could be all nice."
Pa said,
"Then Grandma's bad."
Ma raised her eyes and looked over the valley.
"Grandma's dead."
They looked at her, all of them, and Pa asked,
"When?"
"Before they stopped us last night."
"So that's why you didn't want them to look."
"I was afraid we wouldn't get across," she said. "I told Grandma we couldn't help her. The family had to get across. I told her. Told her when she was a-dying. We couldn't stop in the desert. There was the young ones and Rosa Sharon's baby. I told her."
She put up her hands and covered her face for a moment.
"She can get buried in a nice green place," Ma said softly. "Trees around in a nice place. She got to lay her head down in California."
The family looked at Ma with a little terror at her strength. Tom said,
"Jesus Christ, you laying there with her all night long." "The family had to get across," Ma said miserably.
Tom moved close to put his hand on her shoulder.
"Don't touch me," she said. "I'll hold up if you don't touch me. That'd get me."
Pa said,
"We got to go on now. We got to go on down."
Ma looked up at him.
Can I set up front? I don't want to go back there no more. I'm tired. I'm awful tired."
They climbed back on the load, and they avoided the long, stiff figure covered and tucked in a comforter, even the head covered and tucked. They moved to their places and tried to keep their eyes from it, from the hump on the comfort that would be the nose, and the steep cliff that would be the jut of the chin. They tried to keep their eyes away, and they could not. Ruthie and Winfield, crowded in a forward corner as far away from the body as they could get, stared at the tucked figure. And Ruthie whispered,
"That's Grandma, and she's dead."
Winfield nodded solemnly.
"She ain't breathing at all. She's awful dead."
And Rose of Sharon said softly to Connie,
"She was a-dying right when we..." "Well, how'd we know?"
he reassured her. Al climbed on the load to make room for Ma in the seat, and Al swaggered a little because he was sorry. He plumped down beside Casey and Uncle John.
"Well, she was old. Guess her time was up," Al said. "Everybody got to die."
Casey and Uncle John turned eyes expressionlessly on him and looked at him as though he were a curious talking bush.
"Well, ain't they?"
he demanded. And the eyes looked away, leaving Al sullen and shaken. Casey said in wonder,
"All night long, and she was alone."
And he said,
"John, there's a woman so great with love, she scares me. Makes me afraid and mean."
John asked,
"Was it a sin? Is there any part of it you might call a sin?"
Casey turned on him in astonishment.
"A sin? No, there ain't no part of it that's a sin.
I ain't never done nothing that wasn't part sin, said John, and he looked at the long, wrapped body.
Tom and Ma and Pa got into the front seat. Tom let the truck roll and started on compression. And the heavy truck moved, snorting and jerking and popping down the hill. The sun was behind them, and the valley golden and green before them. Ma shook her head slowly from side to side.
It's purty, she said. I wished they could have saw it.
I wish so too, said Pa.
Tom patted the steering wheel under his hand.
They was too old, he said. They wouldn't have saw nothing that's here. Grandpa would have been a-seeing the Injuns and the prairie country when he was a young fella. And Grandma would have remembered and seen the first home she lived in. They was too old. Who's really seeing it is Ruthie and Winfield. Pa said,
Here's Tommy, talking like a growed-up man. Talking like a preacher, almost.
And Ma smiled sadly.
He is. Tommy is growed way up. Way up so I can't get a hold of him sometimes.
They popped down the mountain, twisting and looping, losing the valley sometimes and then finding it again. And the hot breath of the valley came up to them, with hot green smells on it, and with resinous sage and tarweed smells. The crickets crackled along the road. A rattlesnake crawled across the road, and Tom hit it and broke it and left it squirming. Tom said,
I guess we got to go to the coroner, wherever he is. We got to get her buried decent. How much money might be left, Pa?
About $40, said Pa.
Tom laughed.
Jesus, are we gonna start clean? We sure ain't bringing nothing with us.
He chuckled a moment, and then his face straightened quickly. He pulled the visor of his cap down low over his eyes, and the truck rolled down the mountain into the great valley. Chapter 19. Once California belonged to Mexico, and its land to Mexicans, and a horde of tattered, feverish Americans poured in. And such was their hunger for land that they took the land, stole Sutter's land, Guerrero's land, took the Grants and broke them up and growled and quarreled over them, those frantic, hungry men, and they guarded with guns the land they had stolen. They put up houses and barns. They turned the earth and planted crops. And these things were possession, and possession was ownership. The Mexicans were weak and fed. They could not resist, because they wanted nothing in the world as frantically as the Americans wanted land. Then with time, the squatters were no longer squatters, but owners, and their children grew up and had children on the land. And the hunger was gone from them, the feral hunger, the gnawing, tearing hunger for land, for water and earth, and the good sky over it, for the green thrusting grass, for the swelling roots. They had these things so completely that they did not know about them any more. They had no more the stomach-tearing lust for a rich acre and a shining blade to plow it, for seed and a windmill beating its wings in the air. They arose in the dark no more to hear the sleepy birds first chittering and the morning wind around the house while they waited for the first light to go out to the deer acres. These things were lost, and crops were reckoned in dollars, and land was valued by principal plus interest, and crops were bought and sold before they were planted. Then crop failure, drought, and flood were no longer little deaths within life, but simple losses of money. And all their love was thinned with money, and all their fierceness dribbled away in interest,
until they were no longer farmers at all, but little shopkeepers of crops, little manufacturers who must sell before they can make. Then those farmers who were not good shopkeepers lost their land to good shopkeepers. No matter how clever, how loving a man might be with earth and growing things, he could not survive if he were not also a good shopkeeper. And as time went on, the businessmen had the farms, and the farms grew larger, but there were fewer of them. Now farming became industry, and the owners followed Rome, although they did not know it. They imported slaves, although they did not call them slaves. Chinese, Japanese, Mexicans, Filipinos. They live on rice and beans, the businessmen said. They don't need much. They wouldn't know what to do with good wages. Why, look how they live. Why, look what they eat. And if they get funny, deport them. And all the time the farms grew larger and the owners fewer, and there were pitifully few farmers on the land anymore, and the imported serfs were beaten and frightened and starved until some went home again, and some grew fierce and were killed or driven from the country. And the farms grew larger and the owners fewer. And the crops changed. Fruit trees took the place of grain fields, and vegetables to feed the world spread out on the bottoms. Lettuce, cauliflower, artichokes, potatoes, stoop crops. A man may stand to use a scythe, a plow, a pitchfork, but he must crawl like a bug between the rows of lettuce. He must bend his back and pull his long bag between the cotton rows. He must go on his knees like a penitent across a cauliflower patch. And it came about that owners no longer worked on their farms. They farmed on paper, and they forgot the land, the smell, the feel of it, and remembered only that they owned it, remembered only what they gained and lost by it. And some of the farms grew so large that one man could not even conceive of them anymore, so large that it took batteries of bookkeepers to keep track of interest and gain and loss. Chemists to test the soil, to replenish. Straw bosses to see that the stooping men were moving along the rows as swiftly as the material of their bodies could stand. Then such a farmer really became a storekeeper and kept a store. He paid the men and sold them food and took the money back. And after a while he did not pay the men at all and saved bookkeeping. These farms gave food on credit. A man might work and feed himself, and when the work was done, he might find that he owed money to the company. And the owners not only did not work the farms anymore, many of them had never seen the farms they owned. And then the dispossessed were drawn west, from Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, from Nevada and Arkansas families, tribes, dusted out, tractored out. Carloads, caravans, homeless and hungry, 20,000 and 50,000 and 100,000 and 200,000. They streamed over the mountains, hungry and restless, restless as ants scurrying to find work to do, to lift, to push, to pull, to pick, to cut, anything, any burden to bear, for food. The kids are hungry. We got no place to live. Like ants scurrying for work, for food, and most of all for land. We ain't foreign. 7 generations back, Americans, and beyond that Irish, Scotch, English, German. One of our folks in the Revolution, and they was lots of our folks in the Civil War, both sides. Americans. They were hungry and they were fierce, and they had hoped to find a home, and they found only hatred. Okies. The owners hated them because the owners knew they were soft and the Okies strong, that they were fed and the Okies hungry. And perhaps the owners had heard from their grandfathers how easy it is to steal land from a soft man if you are fierce and hungry and armed. The owners hated them. And in the towns, the storekeepers hated them because they had no money to spend. There is no shorter path to a storekeeper's contempt, and all his admirations are exactly opposite. The town men, little bankers, hated Okies because there was nothing to gain from them. They had nothing. And the laboring people hated Okies because a hungry man must work. And if he must work, if he has to work, the wage payer automatically gives him less for his work, and then no one can get more. And the dispossessed, the migrants flowed into California. 250,000 and 300,000. Behind them, new tractors were going on the land and the tenants were being forced off. And new waves were on the way, new waves of the dispossessed and the homeless, hardened, intent, and dangerous. And while the Californians wanted many things, accumulation, social success, amusement, luxury, and a curious banking security, the new barbarians wanted only two things, land and food, and to them the two were one. And whereas the wants of the Californians were nebulous and undefined, the wants of the Okies were beside the roads, lying there to be seen and coveted, the good fields with water to be dug for, the good green fields, earth to crumble experimentally in the hand, grass to smell, oaten stalks to chew until the sharp sweetness was in the throat. A man might look at a fallow field and know, and see in his mind that his own bending back and his own straining arms would bring the cabbages into the light, and the golden eating corn, the turnips and carrots. And a homeless hungry man, driving the roads with his wife beside him and his thin children in the back seat, could look at the fallow fields which might produce food but not profit, and that man could know how a fallow field is a sin, and the unused land a crime against the thin children. And such a man drove along the roads and knew temptation at every field, and knew the lust to take these fields and make them grow strength for his children and a little comfort for his wife. The temptation was before him always. The fields goaded him, and the company ditches with good water flowing were a goad to him. And in the south, he saw the golden oranges hanging on the trees, the little golden oranges on the dark green trees, and guards with shotguns patrolling the line so a man might not pick an orange for a thin child, oranges to be dumped if the price was low. He drove his old car into a town. He scoured the farms for work. Where can we sleep the night? Well, there's Hooverville on the edge of the river. There's a whole raft of Okies there. He drove his old car to Hooverville. He never asked again, for there was a Hooverville on the edge of every town. The ragtown lay close to water, and the houses were tents and weed-thatched enclosures, paper houses, a great junk pile. The man drove his family in and became a citizen of Hooverville. Always they were called Hooverville. The man put up his own tent as near to water as he could get, or if he had no tent, he went to the city dump and brought back cartons and built a house of corrugated paper. And when the rains came, the house melted and washed away. He settled in Hooverville, and he scoured the countryside for work, and the little money he had went for gasoline to look for work. In the evening the men gathered and talked together. Squatting on their hams, they talked of the land they had seen.
"There's 30,000 acres out west of here, laying there. Jesus, what I could do with that. With 5 acres of that, why, hell, I'd have everything to eat. Notice one thing. They ain't no vegetables, nor chickens, nor pigs at the farms. They raise one thing, cotton, say, or peaches, or lettuce. Another place'll be all chickens. They buy the stuff they could raise in the dooryard. Jesus, what I could do with a couple pigs. Well, it ain't yourn, and it ain't gonna be yourn. What we gonna do? Kids can't grow up this way. In the camps, the word would come whispering, there's work at Shafter. And the cars would be loaded in the night, the highways crowded, a gold rush for work.
At Shafter, the people would pile up, five times too many to do the work. A gold rush for work. They stole away in the night, frantic for work. And along the roads lay the temptations, the fields that could bear food. That's owned.